Hello, and thank you for joining us for the 9th Beyond Biotech podcast. As we endure yet another heatwave in parts of Europe, it's an unheard of 28 here today in the country that used to be known as Rainy Scotland. And I guess the last thing that anyone needs with soaring energy prices is to have to run aircon and fans. I'm Jim Cornell from labiotech.eu, or as one person I talked to in the US recently called it, LA Biotech. No palm trees or Pacific Ocean view here. This podcast is going out on August the 12th, which is World Elephant Day, and it's also the day in 1955 that the US minimum wage went up to $1 an hour. And no, I don't remember it. It was one of those weeks on a personal level that I'd rather forget, so maybe we should just head right into who the guests are this week. I must say I enjoyed last week's four interview podcast so much that I've broken with my own protocol again, and we have four this time as well. And so this week our guests are Arch Venture Partners Managing Director Christina Bureau, founder and CEO of MicroPep, Thomas Laurent, Kylie O'Keefe, the SVP, Commercial and Corporate Strategy at PTC Therapeutics, and Juan Carlos Jaramillo, Chief Medical Officer at Valneva. And so that means it's time to run through some of the news you may have missed at labiotech.eu. Not that this recap is an excuse to not go there and actually read some of them. We had an article on how biotech can help tackle the plastic problem, one on the top 10 biotechs in Taiwan, and another country focus looking at companies in Lithuania. The first patient has been enrolled on Panbela's trial for the treatment of pancreatic cancer. Gemini Therapeutics and Disc Medicine announced a merger agreement. Synlogic enlisted Ginkgo Bioworks' help to launch a T-Rex-inspired synthetic biotic for gout, and AstraZeneca completed its takeover of Teneo2. Stem cell therapy is to be used in the treatment of long COVID by Panacell Biotech. We had an interview on how the UK Precision Breeding Bill could unshackle gene editing, and a new research discovery may help diagnose and treat cancer and brain disorders. Captor Therapeutics named its lead candidate in the fight against hepatocellular carcinoma. Asthma is in the spotlight as Upstream Bio started a trial, and some UK universities proposed a new long-term treatment for asthma. Verona Pharma's lung disease drug met its primary endpoint in a Phase 3 trial. Pfizer and Valneva are starting a Phase 3 Lyme disease vaccine study, and you can hear more about that shortly. We had a couple of updated articles and a guest column on the state of health tech in Europe. Dallas College received an $8.8 million grant to grow the biotech workforce in North Texas. Epigenic Therapeutics raised $20 million for gene editing technology. And Genmab and BioNTech expanded their collaboration to develop and commercialize immunotherapy candidates. You can read all of these, and a whole lot more, at labiotech.eu. And I must say that there is no truth in the rumour that I didn't include some articles in the roundup because they're hard to pronounce. And so let's get to our first guest, and why not kick things off with PTC Therapeutics. The company's drug Upstaza has been given marketing authorization by the European Commission. It's the first approved disease-modifying treatment for aromatic L-amino acid decarboxylase deficiency, better known as, and easier to say, as AADC. And Upstaza is also the first marketed gene therapy that is directly infused into the brain. Kylie O'Keefe, SVP of Commercial and Corporate Strategy at PTC Therapeutics, can tell us more.
All right. So I guess the first and most obvious question is if you could give me a bit of background on PTC Therapeutics.
Absolutely. PTC was founded over 25 years ago. And our CEO and founder, Dr. Stuart Peltz, who still runs the company today, founded PTC on the basis of RNA biology. We are now an enduring biopharmaceutical company that is globally located in over 20 countries worldwide, and we have a footprint in over 50 countries. We're approximately 1,300 employees today. we started with our mission, and this has not changed throughout the years, was to basically use innovative science to deliver and develop treatments to patients with rare disorders who have high unmet medical need, so no other treatments available to them. We have 5 marketed products to date. We have 6 programs in development, and we have a number of different scientific platforms that we pull on to develop research programs that move obviously into development, so in clinical trials, and then towards commercialization. And we have a goal of bringing to market 1 commercialized therapy every 2 to 3 years. And this is still with the focus of rare disorders. We use a number of different technologies. So for example, for our splicing programs, for our bioelectron programs, metabolic, we have small molecules. So that's orally bioavailable treatments. And then we also have gene therapies. And that's what we're here to talk about today is Upstaza. And so we utilize both technologies with research and development programs.
Before we even talk about the drug itself, I wonder if you could, or the treatment itself, I wonder if you could tell me about the condition that it's addressing and what current treatments there are for AADC.
Yeah, AADC deficiency is a rare inborn error of neurotransmitter biosynthesis. And this is resulting from mutations in the DDC gene. And this is encoding for the AADC enzyme. So the lack of the AADC enzyme leads to severe deficiency of dopamine and production. And without dopamine, this is really important because patients are unable to gain motor function or achieve motor developmental milestones. So essentially, this means that babies are unable to have the ability to move. And this is really important because they lack the ability to have developmental growth. So they can't do what normal babies commonly do, which is lift their head, feed by themselves, sit up, roll, crawl, stand, and walk. And commonly, they are often on breathing tubes as well. These symptoms start in the first few months of life, and unfortunately, death usually occurs in childhood and results from failure to thrive as well as from infection. Another aspect of this disease, which is really quite painful, is what we call oculogenic crisis, which is seizure-like symptoms where the eyes are rolling up towards the top of the head. What this commonly leads to is actually misdiagnosis of this disease because patients are thought to have either epilepsy in many cases or cerebral palsy. And you asked a little bit about treatments as well. Well, until the recent approval of Upstaza, there was no disease-modifying therapies available for these patients. So there was only symptomatic treatments as well as associated supportive care. And what this meant was there was even more misdiagnosis because the motivation to secure the correct diagnosis in many cases was absent. And so PTC has instituted a number of genetic testing programs to help families secure the right diagnosis and ultimately hopefully get access to treatment. We've done this through a number of at-home saliva-based testing programs or physician-based programs in over 20 countries worldwide.
How was it previously diagnosed?
So it's still diagnosed with genetic testing, but often this genetic testing is not widespread. So in other words, to get access to these genetic testing panels and programs, it was very limited and difficult for families to have access to. And in some cases, it was quite costly. So what PTC was able to do was make it more accessible to patients and at no cost.
So could you tell me a bit about the development of Upstaza?
So Upstaza development began in 2010. So that was when the first patient was treated. So we have been in development for over a decade. So the Upstaza positive opinion was based on a number of clinical studies as well as compassionate use treatment in Europe. And this was looking at the evidence of clinical benefit that was demonstrated across all AADC patients that were treated. And this included acquisition of motor milestones, improvement in neuromuscular function, reduction in life-threatening infections, improvement in cognitive function, increase in weight gain, which is very important, and other symptoms that are relevant to the disease. Importantly, these clinical benefits that were demonstrated in all patients was able to demonstrate durability. And durability is really key for a gene therapy as it's a one-time administered therapy. And these results and clinical improvements were measured up to 10 years post-treatment and were able to be continually demonstrated. And so from that perspective, durability was seen over that full period. These clinical results in the compassionate use were able to demonstrate efficacy and safety that was used as part of the regulatory process.
And you mentioned the fact that when this is diagnosed early, that most people sadly would die in their sort of teens. How long is this extending life for? Obviously, you don't have data for, you know, 50, 60 years, but what are the prognosis for patients?
Yeah, ultimately, as Upstaza is a disease-modifying therapy, we're delaying the course of the disease. And as you said, we obviously don't have data beyond the 10 years at this point, but we will continue to follow the patients. And what we're seeing is all of those clinical benefits that I was mentioning before are extending through that 10-year period. So in that time, in many cases, they would not be able to lift their head. They would not sit up. They would not be able to stand or walk. They would not be able to feed by themselves. And they require round-the-clock care from caregivers. And in many cases, caregivers have to give up their jobs and become full-time carers. And so what this treatment is able to do from the patient perspective is allow the patient to sit up, hold their head up, talk, engage with the families, sit, crawl, stand, in many cases, walk, and engage with the families, which is a really big deal in the AADC community. And it also reduces the amount of full-time care that a child would need.
And as far as administration, how is Upstaza administered?
So Upstaza replaces the entire human AADC gene. So therefore, it is able to address that dopamine deficiency that I was mentioning earlier, regardless of the underlying gene mutation. Another pioneering aspect of Upstaza is its method of administration. So it's directly infused into the putamen in the brain, which is a really key site for dopamine production. So we're addressing the cause at the root of where it needs to be addressed. And how Upstaza is treated is using a neurosurgical technique that is called stereotactic surgery. And this is used in a number of other pediatric and adult neurological disorders. The surgery has shown to be safe, as well accepted by neurosurgeons, and is actually minimally invasive surgical approach. So it uses somewhat of a Google map to identify the right parts of the brain where the gene therapy needs to be directly infused into the brain. And it is delivered by very highly skilled and well-trained neurosurgeons at sites that have been identified as treatment centers of excellence.
And I guess you just recently got European Commission marketing authorization for this. And what does that mean for your company?
Yeah, I think this is a tremendous occasion for PTC. It is the first gene therapy for PTC to be approved. But even if you look at the gene therapy landscape as a whole, it's the first gene therapy that's been approved in a number of years. It's the third ever to be marketed. And it's the first ever to be approved that is directly infused into the brain. And so PTC is pioneering in many of the different diseases that we're working on, but we're also pioneering in gene therapy. So this was a momentous step forward that we're able to work with regulators to bring this therapy to patients.
What is it going to mean for people in Europe and people that are able to get this new treatment?
Yeah, I think at PTC, patients are at the center of everything we do. And that's really been our mission since the very beginning, is being able to bring therapies to patients with diseases that often get forgotten. And this is no exception. And I think the AADC community has been with us throughout this journey, obviously always wanting it to go faster, but obviously sticking with us through this time. And I think from the AADC community perspective, it gives them the opportunity to have hope. In the past, they've had only symptomatic treatments and supportive care, but now they have a treatment that's able to change the course of the disease and treat the underlying cause of the disease. And instead of having that natural history of the disease, as I mentioned earlier, with the inability to develop those motor milestones, you are able to potentially have access to transformational clinical benefit, which is a huge difference to these not only patients' lives, but also families and caregivers that, as I mentioned, have this round-the-clock care that's required for these young children.
I think one of the things that really struck me about the press release when it came out was the fact that it included a quote from someone directly affected by the condition, which you don't really see a lot in press releases. Do you think that it's easy for companies to get so focused on developing the drugs that they don't kind of make that connection to the end patient?
Yeah, I think that's very fair. Yes, I think it's easy to get focused on the sort of steps you need to take to develop the drug, to bring it to market, working with regulators, answering questions, initiating additional studies if necessary, and losing sight of the end goal. But I think that's something at PTC that we really try and keep close to our heart, as that community and the patients and the families and why we do what we do. And, you know, we have some very strong quotes from different members of the AADC community that helped us sort of keep our eyes on why we do what we do. And one of them is that, you know, there was a quote that said, "Thank you for everything you do for us." And that's a really important quote. But the other one was also, "You have helped us transition from full-time carers to once again become parents." And I think that is probably one of the most powerful quotes that has meant something to me, is we've taken two people that have a child from being a full-time carer, which is maybe something they didn't choose to do, to be able to become parents again.
And is there anything else in the pipeline that you could tell me about?
PTC, as I mentioned, has a number of different scientific platforms, and some of these have developments in what we call late stage development. So they have near-term value drivers. Starting with the BioE platform, we have vatiquinone, which is a treatment in development for mitochondrial disease-associated seizures and Friedreich ataxia. These are both rare diseases. So mitochondrial disease-associated seizures is approximately 20,000 patients worldwide, with Friedreich ataxia approximately 25,000 patients worldwide. And neither of these diseases have disease-modifying therapies available to patients. So this would be a big step forward in the care of these patients. In addition to that, we also have, in our metabolic scientific platform, we have a trial for PTC923 in PKU. And similarly to mitochondrial disease and Friedreich ataxia, PKU is a rare disease, so roughly around 58,000 patients globally. There are two disease-modifying therapies that are available to patients, but still huge unmet medical need remaining. This is through whether it be initial failures with the current therapies or the fact that patients are still therapy naive, so they've not been able to have benefit from these existing therapies. And also, in addition to that, over time, in many cases, patients become poorly controlled on the existing therapies. So all across the board, high unmet medical need there. In addition to that, in some of our earlier pipeline, we have, in our splicing therapeutic platform, we have PTC518 for Huntington's disease. Huntington's disease is around 45,000 patients in the US, around 135,000 patients globally. And this is a neurodegenerative disorder that is diagnosed roughly in the 30s to 40s age group and over time progresses. Again, no disease-modifying therapies available, and we are in a phase 2 clinical study for that. And last but not least, we also have another program in our BioE platform, small molecule, that is PTC857 for the treatment of ALS. ALS is also a very debilitating disease, neurodegenerative, and progresses very quickly. There are some therapies on market, but similar to PKU, still huge unmet medical need. And so we are in a phase 2 clinical trial for ALS as well.
Next, we will head to French ag biotech company Micropep, which develops biological micropeptide-based solutions for agriculture and recently completed a financing round. To tell us what the company does and what the funding means is Micropep CEO Thomas Laurent.
So I guess if you could give me a little bit of background on the company.
Micropep is a biotechnology company based in France, in south of France, in Toulouse. So we are leveraging artificial intelligence and biotechnology to discover very small proteins. We call them micropeptides, with first key application in agriculture. So we are developing typically biofungicide and bioherbicide products based on our internal discovery platform. So the company is 6 years old, so I co-founded it in 2016 with two scientists from a public research laboratory here in Toulouse. We are today 35 employees, mostly dedicated to research. The company is VC-backed, so we raised 4 million euros in 2018 first with Sophie Nova Partner as a lead investor. Then we raised our Series A in 2021 with Supernova Invest as a lead and FMC Venture as another investor. And very recently, we announced an extension of this Series A with a new investor called Fourline Capital, with a pure player in the ag tech investment space.
You develop biological micropeptide solutions for agriculture. And if you could explain what the micropeptides are for those that aren't familiar.
So when you look at agriculture in particular, so we have two main kinds of technologies, let's say, so far categories. So the first one is chemistry. So typically artificial molecules that target key enzyme or key processes within plants or bugs, fungi or insects. So that's the conventional chemistry technology type of technologies. And then you have a big category of what's called biologicals that mostly include so far microorganisms. So, you know, bacteria, fungi, things like that, with either fungicidal or herbicidal or insecticidal properties. The most commonly known today is Bacillus thuringiensis, BT, which is a well-known insecticide. And in fact, there is a new space that is starting to emerge in the ag space with a new category of technologies that regroups natural molecules, but are not living organisms. And so in that, I include RNA, same as in vaccines, but also proteins, and proteins with different form and sizes. So we have big proteins and very, very small proteins that are called peptides. Typically, both peptides and proteins are composed of amino acids. And the small difference is that, in fact, proteins are just big peptides. And so at MicroPep, we specialize in very small proteins called micropeptides that are typically 10 amino acids long. So there's a specific sequence of amino acids that give the signature of a micropeptide. And the signature gives the molecule its function. So we have some micropeptides that have an effect on plant resistance against disease. We have other peptides that have an effect on plant growth. And so what we do is that we browse natural material, so typically genomic information, to look at sequences of potential peptides candidates for specific functions. And we then test them, so synthesize those peptides, test them, select the ones that have the best properties in terms of efficacy on the desired phenotype, and the best properties to be easy to produce, which was also a key element that we invested in. And so as of today, we have built a platform that really gathered these three main components around micropeptide development for ag in particular, which are finding compounds that have strong activity, finding compounds that are easy to formulate, and finding compounds that are easy to produce. And that's the core of the technology platform that we have built. So we're really leading the field into this new category of molecules. And I truly believe that the same as RNA truly revolutionized the world of vaccines, I do believe that small proteins and macropeptides in particular can really change the industry in agriculture in particular.
And so what are the applications within agriculture? How will this help farmers?
The beauty of the technology, and also one of the challenges, that it potentially can be applied to many, many different types of plant physiological processes. So that's why we started with a platform. So MicroPep is not a single product company. It's really started with a discovery platform. So, of course, we decided to specialize in two categories. So we have two programs running so far at MicroPep. The first one is on finding peptides to protect plants against disease, so fungicidal applications. So typically, either finding peptides that can directly kill fungi that are attacking plants, or peptide that can strengthen the resistance mechanism within plants. So that's the first type of program. And another application we are also developing, which is very, very interesting and exciting, is around herbicidal application. So there, the idea is to find peptides that can block, stop the growth of multi-resistant weeds. And that's, as of today, the two core focus of the company.
And so are there implications for things like food safety, food security, sustainability?
So what is interesting with this type of compounds, when you talk about proteins, that they can degrade very fast in different environments. So humans, insects, mammals are used to digest and degrade proteins, which is very, very different from, you know, artificial compounds or chemistry. Those type of new molecules have a very strong compatibility with food safety and food security. So that's the beauty of it. So we don't see this type of technology having a negative impact on the environment. On the contrary, they can degrade very fast in soils. They can be applied almost post-harvest. So you won't find trace of residues in the food. So it's almost without any dangers for both consumers, more than both, for consumers, for farmers, and of course, for the environment.
What kind of safety testing have you done on the product?
We've done several of that. So one way to look at safety is around the signature I was talking about. So the sequence of the compound to see if it can have potential off-target effect or if it can have potential toxicity effect. So there's already a big part of predictivity because as of today, there are some, let's say, motif in peptides or amino acid composition that are known to be potential danger. So, of course, we rule that out from our screening or design process by using computational biology. So that's the first, let's say, safety net. And then, of course, we go through the necessary trials that exist when you want to have a first product on the market. So AIMS, MNT test, we perform a lot also of degradability tests in-house to see how stable our compounds are in different type of environments. And yeah, very good results on that front.
Of great importance these days seems to be biodiversity and pollination, and there's always issues around less bees and less insects. Does it have any effect in that at all?
So same here, it's part of the studies that we were conducting. We also know no red flags. And that's also something we look at within the sequence. So I talked about the signature. Usually the signature of a micropeptide is unique to a given function, but it can also be unique to a very specific species. So we can have very selective compounds that have effect only on a unique type of crop or a unique type of fungi. And we maximize the chances to not harm any other species. I would say that among the different technologies that exist today, this is one of the most powerful in terms of safety for mammals or also for consumers.
You mentioned the recent funding that you received. What will that allow you to do?
So as of today, the company is transitioning from research to development. So it's something that is a bit similar than the development of a new drug in pharma. You start first with an idea, and during the research phase, you design compounds, you try to find the most promising compounds that have not only an effect on the target, but is also selective, that you can also produce, which is a big part of the investment we made, and that you can formulate. And we now have a few of these compounds, especially on the fungicide projects, that we validated in fields, and that are now moving on to the development phase. So this new round of funding is about funding this the beginning of our development work. So that means typically scaling up production of those leads, investing in formulation development of those base leads, and conducting more field trials, and starting the first regulatory package for submission in different countries.
And as far as the commercialization goes, how far are you along with this, and what does the commercialization of the product look like?
We foresee that our first product could be launched more likely in the US or in the Americas by 2025, 2026. It's going to be more likely 2027 or so in Europe, just because regulatory process and is just much longer in Europe than in the US. And so the idea is to, for the company really, because that's the core of what we do, is really to own the intellectual property around each compound, and also to own the market authorization for the active ingredient, which is the micropeptide, and then find different types of partners to put that on the market. So whether it would be distribution partners, or why not corporates that have also their own brands and that have already access to the final consumers. So we are currently exploring both avenues with different people in the industry.
And how will you promote that to industry in terms of the product that you have? What would you say the selling point would be in terms of price point and what it will be able to achieve?
So that's part of the product design, so the constraints we are setting ourselves. When you look at what farmers want and what they do, so of course, environmental protection is important, but I would say even before that, the real question is how much money they can make during this season, and is the product that I'm going to use going to provide value? So it's very important for us to understand that and position a product that is efficient. So efficiency, efficacy is of primary importance. That is cost competitive. And of course, depending on the targets, the budget a farmer can commit to, let's say, a fungicide is not the same. The easiness to use that, typically on some crops, farmers can spray 8-10 times, like potato, grapes. When it comes to other row crops like wheat, they only spray once or twice. So a product that you want to put on the market for wheat should be carefully thought so that it's easy for a farmer to use it with one or two sprays. And with the value we want to propose is a new mode of action. So a new category of compounds of molecules that provide efficacy with a different mode of action, and I'll come back to that, with, I would say, on par cost of goods with more environmental benefits. And when I talked about mode of action, one of the big questions behind that is also tackling the resistance issue, which is a big thing that is already happening in agriculture. Same as resistance against antibiotics for humans. You have lots of weeds and even fungi or insects, but especially weeds that have developed resistance against conventional chemistry. One of the targets we're working on is called super weeds. It's called Palmer amaranth, which is a weed that produces millions of seeds and that have developed resistance against glyphosate and other chemicals. And so farmers are now in desperate needs to find new tools to be able to control those type of resistant weeds.
Public opinion is looking towards more environmentally friendly options. And I think we're getting to the stage where government's going to start legislating for that as well. So that's probably useful in what you're doing as well.
Yeah, there are very strong drivers that I think are beneficial for this new type of technologies. And I include, you know, other companies that are working in, let's say, similar or not too far type of technologies. We know that farming is has evolved a lot and is going to evolve a lot more. And also consumer needs to better understand how we produce our food. So food safety, for me, also encompasses not only the quality of what we eat, but also supply chain and making sure we have enough for everyone. And there's very strong positive drivers for the type of approach we have. And that's a key driver for me also. So yeah, I'm a happy for $2. I know they're already going to grow in a very different world than the one I grew in. I was born in the 80s, so I had, I think, a very nice childhood. The world is changing. Climate change is a big thing. The weather is changing. Pressure on crops is changing. Commercial chemistry works, but is challenged by resistance and, of course, by their impact on the environment. So there's a huge need to find new approaches that can provide good benefits for farmers and for consumers. And I strongly believe that there's still a big untapped potential in this type of compounds that we are developing.
Next, we will talk about something that hit the news this week, and it was the partnership between Valneva and Pfizer, who started their Phase 3 Lyme disease vaccine study. It's great news, and to tell us more is Juan Carlos Jaramillo, Chief Medical Officer at Valneva.
First, if you could give me a bit of background on your company.
Yeah, sure. So who we are here at Valneva, we are a fully integrated specialty vaccine company. We focus on the development and commercialization of prophylactic vaccines for infectious diseases with significant unmet medical needs. We also have a highly specialized and we use a targeted approach in our development of our unique prophylactic vaccines. And of course, we also have an advanced pipeline of differentiated clinical stage assets, which is designed to address large targeted populations. We also have a very highly experienced leadership team, both with vaccine development and also regulatory expertise. And we've clearly demonstrated that we have the ability to rapidly move clinical development all the way from bench to commercialization, as we have done it with VLA-2001, or COVID-19 vaccine. Also right now, our chikungunya vaccine that we were able to move from phase 1 to phase 3, in which we reported positive top line results for the trial. And as you know, for Lyme, we've entered now into the phase 3, which is being led by Pfizer. We also have a specialist sales infrastructure, which commercializes two of our products. Ixiaro, which is our Japanese encephalitis vaccine, and also Dukoral for ETEC and cholera. And we also have highly developed, nimble and sophisticated manufacturing infrastructure. So in a nutshell, this is what Valneva is, and I'm very proud to be working for such a company.
Okay, I wonder if you could tell me about the relationship with Pfizer.
Yeah, sure. So we entered in collaboration with Pfizer back in April 2020. For us, Pfizer is an ideal partner given its position as an established global leader in vaccines, especially in the infectious disease area. They have a proven track record in late stage development, of course, manufacturing, especially in the area of market access and commercialization. They also have a large expertise in tick-borne diseases, which they already have a marketed tick-borne encephalitis vaccine, TBE, called Ticovac. And it is one of the leading tick-borne encephalitis vaccines here in many European markets. So for us, it was important that we collaborated and entered into this agreement with Pfizer, knowing that we could use both Valneva's expertise in the early development of our VLA15, which is our Lyme vaccine candidate, and also taking advantage of Pfizer's global structure, as I mentioned.
Lyme disease, why is it so challenging?
Yeah, so one of the biggest problems seems to involve the cases where the infection goes undiagnosed for a long time. The delay of the diagnosis is getting the prompt treatment, which gives the bacteria or organism time to infiltrate the nerve cells, for example, the brain, other organs, and connective tissue. Again, making it hard to purge from the body.
And I guess one of the things about Lyme disease as well is that climates seem to be changing to the point that it seems to be becoming more of an issue. How widespread is it, and is it growing because of potentially climate change?
Yes, currently right now, if you look at the estimated cases each year in the U.S., it's around 476,000. And here in Europe, the approximately 130,000 cases are reported per year. And of course, this places a heavy burden on countries in North America and Europe, as I mentioned. So there is a medical need for vaccination against Lyme disease, which is steadily increasing as the disease footprint widens. As I mentioned before, left untreated, the disease can disseminate and cause more serious complications affecting the joints, for example, arthritis, the heart with carditis, or the nervous system.
And so the drug that you're developing, could you tell me about VLA15 and how it works?
Yeah, so the vaccine candidate, VLA15, is the only Lyme disease vaccine candidate currently in clinical development. This investigational is a multivalent protein subunit vaccine, uses an established mechanism of action for a Lyme disease vaccine that targets what we call the outer surface protein A, OSPA, of the Borrelia burgdorferi, which is the bacteria that causes Lyme disease. We know that OSPA is one of the most dominant surface proteins that is expressed by the bacteria when present in a tick. So the mechanism of action is by blocking this OSPA, which inhibits the bacterium's ability to leave the tick, and therefore vaccination with VLA15 vaccine candidate may prevent the infection in humans and consequently Lyme disease. So the vaccine does cover the six most common OSPA serotypes in both North America and Europe.
And I guess you're about to start the phase 3 study. Could you tell me about the study and what the goals are on that and what kind of timeline we're looking at?
Yeah, sure. So just a quick overview. I mean, currently, you know, both Valneva and Pfizer, we have 3 active trials in progress for VLA15. We have 2 ongoing phase 2 trials, which we named them VLA15-201 and the VLA15-221. And these are currently in the booster phase of the development. We are now assessing the safety, the immunogenicity, and the vaccine persistence of protection in participants aged 5 years to 65. The third phase is the phase 3 trial, which we've named it VALOR, which stands for Vaccines Against Lyme for Outdoor Recreationists, which was initiated early this week. This study, this phase three study, is assessing the efficacy, safety, tolerability, and immunogenicity of VLA15 in participants 5 years and older. The primary endpoints of the VALOR trial, phase three trial, we're looking at efficacy both at clinically and laboratory confirmed Lyme disease. We're also looking at safety endpoints. So, for example, looking at prompt local reactions such as pain in the injection site, redness, swelling. We also looked at prompt systemic events such as fever, headache, fatigue, muscle pain, and joint pain. Your question was, when are the results of the study expected or timeline? So there's currently no finalized date for the data publication. Again, it all depends on the recruitment timelines, but we will be sharing more information as the phase three program develops.
Different vaccines have different sort of efficacy in terms of the length of time. With the COVID, it's keeping having boosters and every 10 years for tetanus. So is this something that is just going to be a one-time injection, or does it have to be repeated at intervals?
So currently the phase three design, we are looking at a three-dose regimen with a booster at least 1 year apart. And this is currently what we're looking for the results. So this will be a seasonal vaccine, again, depending on the data that will be generated from this phase three trials. So more information, of course, will come as we get closer to publishing the data for this trial.
And at the beginning, you mentioned working with Pfizer. Are there any other things that you're working on with Pfizer or with other companies? And just kind of get a feel for what else is in the pipeline.
Yeah, so currently, this is the only project that we are collaborating with Pfizer. We are accelerating our preclinical pipeline. So we are looking at other indications. And we're looking currently now is for Valneva to bring these products into further clinical development stages. We have four preclinical candidates that there will be more communication around these assets as time goes on.
And now it's over to the US to talk about biotech funding with Arch Venture Partners Managing Director Christina Burrow. The company recently closed a huge $2.975 billion venture fund. That's a lot of cash to make a whole lot of difference. So could you first tell me a little bit about Arch?
Arch is an early stage venture capital fund. We started 35 or so years ago out of University of Chicago and Argonne National Labs. That's actually where the AR and CH in our names comes from, Argonne and Chicago. Over those three plus decades, we focused on creating new companies that are focused on big innovations, big steps forward in the fields of life sciences, physical sciences, and efforts at the interface. We've since, in the last four or five funds, really focused on innovations in life science and used our expertise and materials to really focus on some true innovation on the tool side of the life science house. Over the life of Arch, we've started well over 200 companies. We've been involved in the inception of those, as well as the continued investment in bringing those companies to, in many cases, very positive outcomes.
What's the attraction for the company in terms of funding biotech?
Yeah, I mean, while biotech as a class and as a class of publicly traded stocks might go up and down, there's two constants that I've found. One is the pace of science and the pace of innovations continues to increase. And the levels of scientific innovation and the innovation that has the potential to really, really move the needle on human disease, that pace has never been faster. And the potential, I think, has never been greater. The other sad constant is that human health and wellness is still on everybody's list of concerns. As we age, we accumulate illnesses, many people do. We see loved ones or ourselves suffer from debilitating diseases. While there have been huge strides in things like cancer, there's still so far to go There are rare genetic disorders of which there are no cures, and those individuals and their families suffer tremendously. Alzheimer's disease is still largely unmet in our ability to really help patients and their families. So, you know, as a class of investments, yes, it goes up and down as something that moves the needle for human wellness and reduction of human suffering. There's a tremendous need. And I think the people who practice in this field, whether it's from ARCH and our, you know, our continued interest in creating companies, or the wonderful academics and entrepreneurs we work with, people are in this business because they fundamentally want to see humans live healthier lives.
Do you think that with capital funds and with funding and investments that sometimes the human side of it gets a bit lost?
I think it's a really interesting question. Certainly, there's been more capital that's come into the market. I think the pandemic has done an interesting job of highlighting to folks, both on a personal and a kind of fund level, and maybe even to governments, the criticality of human health and the impact innovative science can have. You know, many decided they wanted to be in this general field, you know, whether it be medicine or scientific innovation. They made those decisions when they were in elementary school, and they worked their whole lives to make drugs and make things that help people.
The latest announcement from your company was about the Venture Fund 12. It comes kind of about a year and a half after the 11th one. Could you tell me about that 11th one and what kind of results came out of that?
We've created a number of fabulous companies over the last few years, many of which have been announced. Companies like Resilience, which is leading the way in removing obstacles and streamlining the world of manufacturing. Again, something that was highlighted in the last 2 years with this awful pandemic. We've invested in companies like Treeline, just really a leading company founded by two of the most successful oncology drug developers in the area. We've made enormous progress in a company called Nemora, which is a leading company in the field of CNS brain diseases, and many, many more. Fund 11, before that Fund 10, we've been extremely busy and have been kind of at the cusp of both backing innovation out of places like Harvard, the Broad, Stanford, MIT, University of Chicago, Scripps, et cetera, and then have also been quite active in some of these larger companies that require a more substantial early stage capital investment, like a company like Resilience. It's been a very busy last 18 months.
Yeah, I can well imagine. Will the new fund that you just announced that's close to $3 billion, will there be any differences in the way that you approach things, or is it more business as usual?
As you said, it's more business as usual. I think we really focus on where the science leads us, and that is what really drives the company formation process. You know, we've been doing that since the inception of ARCH. So it's really driven on what's the most innovative science, who are the best teams and the best people we can recruit to these efforts, and we build from there.
And what's the strategy that you have when it comes to looking for investing in a specific company? Although I suppose it varies.
It does vary, but I think the one constant is, will it matter? So, you know, we get involved so early in the process that, you know, if you have to ask yourself, you have to do a deep commercial assessment and really think about if you're going to be third or fourth in line when the product is launched, you know, maybe it's not worth the early work and the early risk. We much prefer investments. We much prefer technology and science where at the inception you can look at it and say, this will transform. This is such a no-brainer that it will help patients. It will be head and neck above everything else, that it justifies taking that early risk and working the years that it's going to take to bring whatever that innovation is ultimately to the market and to the patients or to the eventual consumer.
What's the strategy when it comes to investing in terms of the amount of money and time scales? Again, I suppose that varies too.
It does, and it's kind of based on what's needed. I've been involved in companies where they really need an initial $50,000 or $200,000 to get to some critical milestone. Maybe it's a tox study, maybe it's access to a high throughput screen. And I've been involved in companies that they need far greater check size to consolidate a space or to get things started in the right way. And Arch now has the flexibility, and we have over the last few funds, we have the flexibility to really right-size that initial capital investment so that we can build a very wide range of different types of companies.
And your approach to working with the companies that you do end up working with, is that very hands-on or hands-off, other than the financial input that you can give?
Yeah, in most cases, it's very hands-on. We help to recruit the team. Sometimes we act as interim management. Oftentimes, we're initial boots on the ground to help operationalize, you know, everything from setting up IT, securing lease space, working out all of the license agreements with the various academic institutions. In many cases, we take a very hands-on approach. Our goal, of course, is to bring in the very best management and then back away so that we can provide continued support as investors and, you know, active board members.
You already mentioned some of the past successes from the other fund. Are there any other companies that you've invested in before that that have been big successes?
Oh, many. You know, companies like Erasca are now public, really leading the way in innovative approaches to cancer. Sana and Lyell in gene and cell therapy, Beam Therapeutics in gene editing, Prime Therapeutics also in gene editing, a different technology. Companies like Twist, it's a little bit of an older company, but Twist is the leading DNA writing company, which has made a huge impact across the industry. We launched a company about 5 years ago called Vividion, which was recently acquired by Bayer, a chemical genomics effort that has really created an enormous swath of innovative programs in the kind of undruggable portions of the genome. Going back to the early days, Arch was the initial investor in a company called Illumina, which really, I think, led to the revolution or was instrumental in the genomic revolution 20 odd years ago. Juno in the cell therapy space, Receptos, which was a nearly an $8 billion exit in the MS and IBD space. But I think we've created well over 30, maybe 40 multi-billion dollar companies over the last 25 years.
Pretty impressive. Are you limited? And is this fund also limited to U.S. companies or is it global?
No, we have a global fund. We have for many, many funds, maybe since inception. We typically have a handful of investments that are global. All of our companies themselves are looking across the globe for technology in licensing. We're looking to in license from the best academic labs in the world. Of course, many of those are based in Europe. I should have mentioned one of our companies in a previous fund, Pretzel, was created out of three European institutions, Gothenburg, Karolinska, and Cambridge. So a multiple country, multiple university effort. And the reason we created it in that way was because those were the leading centers of excellence in mitochondrial research. We also have a partner now based in Europe, Sean Kendall, who recently moved from Chicago to Ireland/London. And we work hard to look at innovations across the globe, Europe as well as Asia.
And that's it. Next week, I hope to have an announcement about a new feature in the podcast. And no, it's not me writing songs about biotech subjects, mainly because I haven't found a good rhyme for gene therapy yet. So we do have some of next week's interviews done, but I can't claim the credit, as one of them was done by our own Liza Laws. And the week after, we're hoping to feature Bio Europe, which isn't really that too far into the future now. I was checking out flights last night, which seemed cheap until you add in the fact that you're not allowed to take a bag on a flight without paying extra these days. Well, that's the case on many airlines. So sometimes you do have to do a little bit more digging because maybe the flight is more, but it maybe includes a bag. So it takes a bit longer to figure it all out. But it will be nice to be back on the road again. All right, so I hope wherever in the world you are that you're not suffering from any extreme weather conditions. And of course, I hope you enjoyed the podcast and that you'll join us again next time for another Beyond Biotech.